Hey, this is Megan Rapinoe. And I'm Sue Bird. We've decided to turn our crazy IG live show into a podcast for your listening pleasure. Enjoy the show.
A Touch More.
New episodes of A Touch More drop Tuesday only on the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
All right, on this week's podcast, we're going to have our friend Kelly Eco from The Athletic discuss his new article on James Harden and what he's been doing during this downtime period with his body. The transformation he's done is incredible, and his article is really good. We're going to talk about it. We're going to continue our Rockets Rewind series with Game 5 of the 2018 Western Conference Finals. That's right, the bittersweet moment Chris Paul turned his hamstring, and the Rockets immediately, but briefly, became the favorites to win the NBA title. All right, guys, hope you guys enjoy the show.
Wire. Russell Westbrook is off to Houston.
It's going
to
be scary. Not for us.
James Harden just caught a body here in Los Angeles.
And Westbrook is on the freeway.
All right, we are joined by The Athletic's Kelly Eco. Kelly, how you doing, man?
What's going on, bro? How you holding in there?
I'm doing all right. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, it makes it easier as you get, as the days go on, you get into a routine of sorts and, you know, just kind of wait out the return of the league.
My routine went right out the window a couple weeks ago. It's getting really hard. It's getting really hard to just maintain the same thing over and over and over again. Like, when you're not seeing people on a regular basis, when you're not interacting face-to-face, like, I get Zoom, I get Skype, I get all that, FaceTime, all that. That's cool. It's not the same.
Yeah, it's not the same, but how? So would you say it's like on a scale of 1 to 10 for you? How bad is it?
I would say about a 6 or 7.
Right? Okay, that's not so bad.
Yeah, but I would say a couple weeks ago I was at a 3. You know, it wasn't.
Okay. But don't you think? On that hand, wouldn't it be, you know, easier given that the NBA is coming back?
It's gonna help a lot. It's gonna help a lot. It's gonna do a lot for my mental. It's gonna do a lot for me. It's gonna do a lot for a lot of people. I imagine sports is good that way. It's weird. It's weird how that works, but it helps a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure.
So we're continuing our Rockets Rewind series today. But before we get to that, I want to talk to you about the article you wrote a couple days ago. So, just as a backdrop, Harden's camp has really been dropping hints that he's really been busting his during this quarantine period. And this goes beyond Instagram stuff. Like, the guy I was talking to kept saying, wait until the season starts, wait until you see the pictures. And I just kind of brushed it off, like, okay, man, I believe you. And you kind of sort of had the feeling that something was coming down the pipeline. But I'll be honest, I did not expect this. First of all, your article is great, and I encourage everyone to go read it on The Athletic. But Harden looks skinny, like skinny. Like, were you shocked when you first saw the images?
Yeah, the first picture was kind of crazy, just given, you know, obviously this time there is no definitive of how NBA guys are staying in shape because, you know, there's going to be a lack of intensity, a lack of facility and equipment. But, man, he looks good.
Yeah, so I remember hearing that a lot of teams didn't really know how to approach the down period because they didn't know how long it would last and they didn't have access to the courts. But the Rockets treated it as a version of the offseason. They really stayed in constant communication with their guys. They sent little kits and workout material to their homes. They provided everything they could. But obviously, the big question was, how do you possibly train for the basketball season without access to a basketball court? Now, clearly, James Harden is a player with more resources than 99% of the NBA. But did Justin Allen and that group of guys around Harden encounter any of those same issues?
You mean in terms of just having the availability?
Yeah, and like just trying to get regular basketball workouts in.
Obviously, it's not going to be as easy as, you know, a normal off season or a normal off day, just because of all the restrictions going on in the city and what you can and can't do. But credit to those guys, they found a way. You know, the outside always works. And I was talking to Justin. He said, you know, it kind of takes you back to the old days of being a kid, you know, background ball. You have to find a way to get it in without a gym or equipment, and you just have to make stuff work. So the sand workouts come into that, you know, the hill, you know, all those drills come from a lack of facilities, if that makes sense.
The images look like a Rocky movie. Like, this guy was doing sand workouts. He was obviously doing a lot of stuff outside. And it looked like the team got really creative. And reading your article, it seemed like obviously Harden had weights. He had workout equipment at his home already. But Justin really helped him, helped guide his workouts and kind of show him how they can properly get ready for the season.
And, you know, Harden is one of those guys. Well, look, different NBA players have different roles, and anybody that watches Houston knows that James's load dictates a lot of uses, a lot of endurance, so you need to have your body in tip-top shape. And while his frame isn't like the chiseled or that kind of like a LeBron-type body, he's still someone who works extremely hard and has a very powerful body. Like, just watching him on a night-to-night basis, you can see that this guy is no slouch. So even though he doesn't have the appearance of, you know, a six-pack or whatever, when it comes down to it, you need to have endurance. You need to have power. You need to have strength. You need to have explosion. And those are all the things that he worked on during that week in Phoenix.
Yeah, and Harden is a muscular dude. Like, you wouldn't know it because he has the jersey on, and he's kind of a hefty upper body kind of guy. But, I mean, we've both seen him without a shirt, and he's definitely really chiseled. It's just hard to see underneath the jersey and underneath the rough exterior. It's really tough to see. And he's got a different body type than most people. And Justin was really talking about this. And it's one of those things where it can be really deceiving. But, yeah, you're right. He is a workout warrior. And people don't really talk about it. Like, after, I would say, that 41-41 season, like, Harden took his approach to his body completely differently. Like, he started taking a lot more better care of himself. Like, he laid off the Chipotle. Like, that was gone. He went in and surrounded himself with the right people. And he started really, really taking his offseason seriously. And this is essentially an extension of the offseason. It's a weird offseason, but it's basically the offseason. 2 months off. The only difference is no basketball courts.
Yeah, and you know, to your point about him changing his body and regime, that kind of happens around the league when you get guys that have improved science, improved knowledge of stuff that works and what doesn't work for your body. And for Harden, he had to change what he ate. He had to change how he worked out, what he worked out on, because, you know, his play style is unique. It like, for example, the plyometrics and the fast twitch muscle fibers, those are for guys that have that quick first step, guys who have those stop-start movements, the deceleration, things that are uniquely tailored to his play style, which is how you're seeing over the years him getting more and more comfortable with those kind of workouts.
Yeah, and there's this perception that Harden isn't very athletic, and that's just wrong. Like, you have to watch his first step, and you have to watch just how quickly he decelerates, right? Everybody knows about this.
Yeah, his footwork is elite. Like, I would put it top five in the league for sure.
100%. For sure. And it's one of those things where, like, it's hard. Like, no one talks about deceleration. That's not a skill that, like you know, you start hearing it recently because of Harden. Like, with guys like Markelle Fultz, like, coming out of the draft, you're starting to hear more and more about deceleration. But it's really still not a part of the NBA vernacular. It's a new term, and it's because of Harden.
Right. And also, another guy that's coming up in those ranks pretty quickly is Luka Doncic with a deceleration. So is another player who can stop on a dime. That's kind of the basic way of saying it, stopping on a dime. But, you know, there's really an exact science that goes into taking your motion and your velocity and just slowing it down gradually against a defender who's going at the same, if not faster, speed. And it's a really incredible thing once you look at all the inner workings of it. But, you know, it's something that the human brain doesn't comprehend in real time. But when you actually sit down and look at it and break it down, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and there's a certain level of gifts that Harden has that other people just won't be able to do. Like, I'm surprised Harden doesn't get the ball stripped from him more often. He's just so strong with the ball, and he puts it in compromising positions all the time to draw fouls, obviously. But it's just not like traditional fundamental basketball to let people just swipe at the ball like that. It's a hardened thing. It's a skill that he developed over time. Right. You saw it in high school in Arizona, but it's very unique to be able to hold the ball that strongly and still be able to finish at the rim or draw the foul.
Yeah, he's a big dude, so it's a hard task getting the ball out of his hands. Obviously, just looking at how defenders play him, you know, you see double teams. You see, there's a reason why he's picked up at full court sometimes. There's a reason why they send doubles. There's a reason why he averages, you know, 35 points a game. It's pretty hard to get the ball out of his hands. So,
right. Credit to him. So the natural question, and you've gotten this a lot ever since you released the article, was like, okay, right. So this is what's going on with Harden. What's going on with Russ, right? Like, what is he doing? So you start seeing pictures of Russ in the background of some of these Harden workouts, right? So you assume he's definitely participating in some of them. But to what extent they're working out together? Is Russ doing his own thing as well? Like, what have you heard on the Russ front?
Well, I've heard that, you know, obviously Russ, the workout you're seeing now, you have to also take into effect, he didn't get a chance to do this last summer. Because he had just come off an injury, off a surgery, he's still recovering from surgery. He didn't get a chance to train, to do the things that he's accustomed to. So now you're seeing that right now. You know, all the explosion drills with Kevin Hart, with just train. That's what he normally does in every offseason. But it looks more emphasized now because he didn't train last summer. So that's kind of what you see. But Russ is a freak of nature. He's always going to be in shape. Doesn't matter how old he is, he's going to be able to jump out the gym. So it's pretty standard for him.
Yeah, I would not worry about Russ coming into training camp out of shape. Like, that's not going to happen. Right. But it's definitely one of those things where, like, you're just curious. Like okay, so Harden's doing all this. So what's Russ doing? It's definitely, I could understand why it would cross someone's mind. But It is very interesting. Like, Harden's body, like, I haven't seen it this skinny in particular since, like, his first year in Houston. Like, it's something I haven't seen before. I'm just curious as to whether or not he's going to be able to translate that to the season. Obviously, it's different. Like, he has to get his reps in. He has to play basketball. But it's going to be a different experience for him, I imagine, playing with this body type compared to the body type he had before.
Right. And that's going to be, you know, for a lot of players who, because like this hiatus came at a pretty, you know, random time in the season when guys are supposed to be getting into that third gear, you know, right before the playoffs. And, you know, it caused a lot of changes for a lot of people quickly. And that's why you've seen so many people say, you know, whoever wins the championship, there's going to be, If you want to put an asterisk, you can put an asterisk. But the truth is that there's going to be a lot of people who have a hard time readjusting to NBA games after it comes back, because being off for two and a half months without the offseason is pretty damning. So, I mean, it's going to be a real test of who's stronger, who's more endured, who has more endurance, and who has, you know, mind. It's going to be a lot of things that go into who wins this specific championship, just apart from, you know, your physical state of being.
Yeah, for sure. But it is going to be interesting. Like I am curious to see how some of the players come out of the gate.
Right.
I'm a little worried about injuries, but I think if that's avoided, I'm interested to see how the play looks.
Yeah, and that's going to be determined by, you know, the training camp regime that they set up before the games. You know, if it's 2 to 3 weeks, if it's 2 weeks, if it's 3 weeks, just seeing how guys are. Because technically, if this was a preseason, there's a gradual increase of, you know, intensity of output given just because the games are going by and you're getting your game legs under you. This is different. This is a stop and a start. So there is going to be an increased chance of injuries, and you have to make sure you manage that.
Yeah, 100%. So we're going to do our Rockets Rewind series, Rockets versus Warriors, Game 5 of the Western Conference Finals. This game has a strong case for being the most bittersweet playoff victory of all time. How vividly do you remember this game?
That was a freaking zoo. I remember this game very well. It was one of those games where I was walking around looking for certain stuff, and I remember, right at the end of the game, I'm seeing two cops arresting this guy who was just so drunk out of his mind. He was just screaming and hooping and hollering. And it was because you could see the emotion. You could see the momentum switch right back to the Rockets' favor because, you know, they had a 3-2 lead.
Yeah.
And it just felt like the way that game went down at the end, especially, it just felt like you could kind of start to see the initial questions. Is this possible? Can they pull it off? And it looked pretty real then.
Yeah. So I want to quickly point out some forgotten highlights because this game, like, I feel like a lot of Rockets fans don't want to go back and watch this game or even watch the highlights because it's really painful for them because of what happened at the end. And we'll get to that, I promise. I really do hope they put this game on NBA TV because it's really, really freaking good. Some of the highlights from this game. So the 4:36 mark of the second quarter, Harden crosses over Steph and turns him around and gets the layup. Like Steph is turning around on the court like a ballerina. And Harden gets the room for the layup. So there's that at the second quarter. The 6:35 mark of the third quarter, this is the infamous Steph is defending Chris Paul on the perimeter, and he's like all up on it in his grill. The shot clock is running down, and Paul hits this ridiculously contested shot, this three-pointer at the buzzer in Steph's eye. And then he shimmies at Steph while Steph is smiling while running down the floor. Steph's trying to avoid eye contact, and I don't remember the shimmy in real time, but I remember the broadcast came around and showed, like, what an amazing moment. Like, do you remember catching it live or did you watch the replay? Because it happened really fast.
Yeah, it happened really fast. I think in the first instance, I didn't know what was going on. I was kind of confused. I didn't think anything of the matter in the moment.
The highlight was really good.
Yeah, it was a great highlight. But, you know, as things unfold, you kind of see that we're, wow, this is potentially some bad news going on. But yeah, it was just a weird night, really. Just because you kind of almost had to think something bad was coming, given that everything couldn't have gone well for the Rockets. It was going too good. Something had to go wrong to mess it up for them. And that was that. That was crazy.
All right, let's talk about our friends at BetOnline. There is no shortage of action going on at our exclusive partner, BetOnline. NASCAR is back, and BetOnline has hundreds of other games, events, and sports to get in on. You can still bet on simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC events 24/7. Or you can participate in a $10,000 Madden Bracket Challenge, a March Madness-style NFL simulation tournament you can enter for free. And live right now on BetOnline's YouTube channel, you'll find an exclusive interview with ex-Chicago Bulls Ron Harper, Horace Grant, Bill Cartwright, and Craig Hodges to discuss Michael Jordan's documentary on what they're calling the final dance. Visit betonline.ag and use promo code BLUEWIRE, all one word, all caps, to receive your new welcome bonus and check out all the action. BetOnline, your online wagering solution. Some other highlights. The 6:43 mark of the fourth quarter, Chris Paul hits a step back three over David West, and the camera flashes to JJ Watt and Justin Timberlake, of all people, and they're both just losing their on the sidelines. They're like the most random odd couple you'd expect to see, both JJ and JT. It was very strange, but it was like the Rockets at that time, Rockets Warriors at that time was a hot ticket because we had hyped that matchup up all season. The Rockets had talked all offseason about how they really wanted to dethrone the Warriors, how they made this Chris Paul trade for the express purpose of taking down the Warriors, and how they had constructed their roster to take down the Warriors. And, you know, all this hype had seeped into the Warriors' locker room, and Draymond was getting really antsy about it, getting asked about it during training camp, during the season, about the Rockets, and Draymond sharing quotes in the Warriors' group chat about it. It's starting to become a thing. And every Rockets-Warriors matchup is must-watch, especially that game one of the regular season where it went down to the buzzer. Kevin Durant hits that buzzer beater, but it ends up not counting. Every game becomes a hot ticket. I just forgot the amount of celebrity that were at these games. Like, in the moment, like you obviously notice it, but like looking back, it's like, oh my God, like you have A-list celebrities all over the court because this is a must-watch matchup for a lot of people.
And Houston has become that kind of hotbed for, you know, getting some kind of big names at the games. Courtside, you see Beyonce, Jay-Z.
Were they at the Cardi series?
Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
Cardi B.
I completely forgot.
Yeah, it was a lot of people because, look, the Warriors were the big bad guys around the league. And this was the first time you really saw a team stand up to them, apart from, and at least as far as the Western Conference is concerned. You know, obviously the Cavs have been there a number of times, but the Rockets were the first guys to say, look, they're not scared of you and you're not going to run over them. So it was, there's a reason why you've seen Justin Timberlake. There's a reason why you saw J.J. Watt, Jay-Z, Beyonce, because people are tuned in. This is high-level basketball, and that was a very well-played high-level series. People forget that because of the 27 missed threes.
They lost by 8. Like, that game was close.
It was still a very highly contested series and a game, Game 7 for sure.
Yeah, I mean, like, this series is awesome. Like, it's an awesome series to go back and rewatch. Like, I know it's painful for a lot of Rockets fans, but it is awesome basketball. Like, the highest of high-level basketball. It becomes a slugfest because both teams are forced to ISO, and it becomes switch everything. And it's basically the best players in the world ISOing on every single possession coming down the stretch. And that's what more entertaining can you get than that? Like, James Harden, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Chris Paul, all those guys isolating on the perimeter, looking for mismatches. Like, that's really, really freaking entertaining.
I think that was one of the biggest storylines of that season, was that the Rockets kind of made the Warriors play like them.
Yeah.
You know, you saw Kevin Durant seeking out what he perceived were, you know, mismatches and the low block on the perimeter instead of the normal ball movement, sexy ball that we've seen from the Warriors over the last 5 years. It was where the Rockets kind of got the best of them mentally, because the Warriors were doing stuff they weren't really used to doing. And you kind of could see Steve Kerr on the sidelines, you know, not pleased at all of what was going on, because at the end of the day, there's a point in time in a series and a game where you just revert to old school tactics, you know, backyard street ball stuff. And Kevin Durant wanted to score on whoever was guarding him, you know, Steph Curry, same thing. And that was where I thought the Rockets had their best chance. It's because if they switch everything and you seek out what you think is a mismatch, it's really not. It's really what they want you to do, because if you score, so be it. If you don't, they get out and running. So no one shoots 100% from the floor. So every shot, there's a 50% chance that you can miss it. If you think about it, it was a really solid strategy from, you know, the Rockets on how to take the Warriors down. And Game 5, you kind of could see the apex of that strategy.
Right. You took the Warriors out of their beautiful ball movement. They're having to post up Kevin Durant on, like, Chris Paul, because that's the best matchup you could find on the floor. Like, again, all five defenders, right, except for, you know, maybe James Harden, like, all five defenders were incredibly strong. PJ Tucker, Trevor Ariza, Chris Paul, like, that's really, really tough to score on. And I think Luke and Bamute closed a lot of games with the Rockets. Like, that's a really, really tough lineup to score on. And even if you can get Chris Paul on the post, like, there's a really good chance he's going to strip the ball from you, or he's going to pull the chair. And it's Harden, obviously, great post defender. If you try him, he's going to put up a good fight. The way they utilized their players, it was so efficient. Like, they maximized all their strengths in such a way that it put them in a really good position to win the series. But so this stretch I just found entertaining. Just going back and rewatching it, I found this entertaining. So the 2:51 mark of the second quarter, Kevin Durant's posting up Chris Paul. Durant gets past Paul. Clint Capella comes in from the weak side, meets Durant at the rim, and stuffs him. The 2:13 mark of the second quarter, transition play. So just a few seconds later, Durant comes down the floor, hits a falling away three in Clint Capella's outstretched arms. It was like a little form of payback. It was a game within a game. So I just found that entertaining.
That was like, see, that segment you just told me, it just reminds me of, there were flashes when Clint could actually show you that he was going to be a really, really good center who could stay on the floor for long periods of time. And that's what makes last season's showing so weird, because he was good against the Warriors in 2018, but he was awful in last season's second round. He was getting outplayed by somebody making less than $2 million in Kevon Looney, which was wild to just see in real time, so much to the point where Mike D'Antoni had to physically get him out of the game and just go small the rest of the way and say, screw it, because he just couldn't stay on the floor. But that 2017-18 series, he was good. He was good.
Yeah, and looking back at it, I kind of regret, like, I think we probably undercovered Clint Capella's infection. Like, because that was significantly bothering him in the series before. And during that series, he just didn't have his wind under him. He was just out of it. And I think he had a heel injury. Am I misremembering that? Did he have a heel injury?
So, a couple of things. Hold on. Carmelo came, what, 2018, 19? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, that training camp, Clint told me it wasn't really his heel. Like, the heel was an issue, but the main thing that was wrong with Clint was his knee, which a lot of people didn't know at the time. And it was some injury he had sustained in the season, but he had gotten hurt. It didn't really heal properly. He came into camp a bit out of shape, but that was also an issue late in 2017-18 because, you know, all the switching and the running and jumping you have to do on the floor against the Warriors, it kind of adds up. And that kind of took its toll besides the heel. You know, it was kind of a compound injury, if that makes sense. The heel was bothering him. His knee was bothering him. His whole leg was bothering him. So it was
a rough going for him. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So the last minute of this game, this is really where the discussion starts. And by now, Chris Paul has effectively taken over the ball handling responsibilities, right? Yeah. And he drives left, spin moves to his right, and attempts this awkward floater over Cook and immediately grabs his hamstring. And it was one of those things where everybody in the building knew exactly what happened because of Chris Paul's history with hamstring injuries. And up until that point, I would say Houston was on path to becoming the prohibitive favorites in Game 6, even though it was in Oakland, because they had a 3-2 lead, and it felt like they figured the Warriors out. And at the drop of a hat, it was gone.
Yeah, and I remember when Chris comes down, you know, off the jump shot, you can kind of see it, but you don't really think it. And in that moment, you just see Mike D'Antoni. His face was—he was trying to put on a brave face, but it was—that was tough to watch those guys go through that, because you can just see Chris, and you go back to the round before that. You know, it was so big for Chris just getting to the conference finals. You know, if you remember how he took over Game 5, he put Harden aside. He said, "I'm doing this," and he literally willed the Rockets to victory in that Game 5 against the Jazz, because up until then, he had never been to the Western Conference Finals, you know, and to see him go down like that in that moment, in that fashion, robbing him of a potentially exhilarating Game 6 or 7 was some really harsh stuff to watch as a basketball fan.
Yeah, and I've talked about this on this podcast before. We underrate how effectively the Jazz have defended James Harden in the playoffs. Like, they've actually done a really good job. And in those in those moments, Chris Paul has taken over and shot these mid-range jumpers, because that mid-range area is open effectively the way the Jazz play Houston. They leave it open.
Right.
They block off the lane, and they take away step-back three-pointers. And Chris Paul feasted on that area. And you're right, he definitely did take over in some of those moments. So this leads me to the central focus of this podcast, because I don't think we as an NBA community talk enough about Chris Paul's hamstring, because national pundits tend to dismiss the injury because Andre Iguodala was also injured. And I gotta say that that logic just infuriates me, because it's intellectually dishonest, and everybody who makes that argument knows what they're doing, and they know they're wrong, but they're doing it anyways. Iguodala at that point was the fifth best player on that Warriors team, and is on the fringes of the Hall of Fame. Chris Paul at that point is a top 15 player, and the clear second best player on that Rockets team, and a lock for the Hall of Fame.
What did you say? Wait. You said fringe Hall of Fame. I don't think he's making the Hall of Fame.
Iguodala?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, it's a disgusting point that I've heard.
C. Webb is not in yet. If Chris Webb is not in yet, and Ben Wallace is not in yet, Andre Iguodala is nowhere in hell making the Hall of Fame before those guys.
We've seen stranger entrance, is all I'll say.
That's true. But no one in their right mind should do that. Now, will they is a different question, but yeah.
Here's what I'll say. I think C. Webb gets in pretty soon. Like, I really do.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, he's earned it, yeah.
And Ben Wallace. Like, golly, you can't, like...
Yeah.
It's out of my hands.
They've made some questionable calls over the years. But, by the way, we should talk to Jonathan about this. I think he was on some of those Hall of Fame voting committees. But, yeah, and that's not even a comparison. Like, Chris Paul was way more important to the Rockets than Iguodala was to Golden State. And it's not even close. Sure. It's not even close.
Nah, it's a stupid argument. Anybody that brings that up is really stupid. I'm sorry. Like you said, it's being intellectually dishonest. If you're just going to say – and look, the Warriors fans will tell you, because when Iguodala was there, they outscored – but that's taken to, in fact, a game two blowout, like, or game three blowout. That doesn't mean anything. in the context of a seven game series, yes, a one game outcome is detrimental to the team that lost. But you can't use that in terms of outscore. That's a stupid stuff. It's really intellectually dishonest to make stuff like that, because you impact a large group of people. It's group thing, and it's an incredibly small sample size. So I just don't like bad arguments, and that was a bad argument for sure.
And it wasn't just the Warriors people that were making this argument. Like, you heard this from national pundits, and that's what.
You were seeing that pretty aggressively over the NBA landscape, which is kind of weird to see.
Yeah, and the other argument you hear is, oh, the Rockets had a chance to put the Warriors away in Game 6 and 7, and they didn't capitalize.
For sure,
and I think that's a little bit more fair. But
no, it's more, that's for sure. Like, they were up. I remember at halftime, my editor had told me to start writing a piece on the Rockets in the finals because it looked like it was done and dusted. And I was like, don't forget the Warriors in them third quarters, because they'll come back at you.
See,
and lo and behold, they just roared back, yeah.
That was my next point, because every time the Rockets gained significant ground on the Warriors after Paul's injury, the lead always felt temporary. Like, everybody in the building never felt relieved,
yeah.
Right? Paul was the stabilizing force on that team when things got tight. And we talked about earlier, he took over the ball handling responsibilities for a reason. Things got tight, and Chris Paul has years of experience in these kind of situations.
Right.
Like,
but
if you go back and watch the tape, Chris Paul is the primary ball handler.
Yeah, because he was arguably the best player in that series before he went down. He was playing at that high of a level. There's some guys you watch playing and you think, damn, this guy really wants it. And Chris is a guy who is an extreme competitor. He doesn't settle for anything less than success, and he really wanted to get to the NBA Finals. So you could see it through all five of those games. So it was tough to see the Rockets trying and maneuver, you know, a tough environment, Oracle Arena. You can kind of see the lead evaporating before your eyes, and not only evaporating, the Warriors just spanked them. So that was pretty wild to see in Game 6. That was really wild.
Yeah, and it's just disheartening for a couple reasons. Actually, a few reasons. Like, so first, obviously, like, that was clearly the best opportunity the Rockets have had in James Harden's era, right? Like, that's, you're not getting better than 65 wins and game seven of the Western Conference Finals. Like, that was easily the best the Rockets have ever looked as a team. And another reason is obvious, that's probably the best chance Chris Paul is ever going to get to win a championship. Like, James Harden still has time. Like, it's getting a little scary, but he still has time to get that chip. Chris Paul, that might have been the best opportunity he's going to get. He's on the Thunder right now. God knows if he's going to get traded. It's looking unlikely. Looks like the Thunder want to keep him, and they're not going to find many suitors for that contract. And even if he gets traded, you wonder if the caliber of team he gets traded to is good enough to compete for a championship on the same level that the Rockets were in 2017-18.
Yeah. Like you said, there were so many storylines that came out from that series because, you know, like you said, longevity, you know, the timeline players have to win championships is very limited in today's day and age, especially for good players. You know, you see guys like James Harden hasn't won that. Damian Lillard hasn't won one. Chris Paul hasn't won one. The list goes on. And when you have those moments to capitalize, you need to take full advantage. And obviously injuries are things you can't control. So that's where you kind of give the Rockets, you know, sympathy, because look, who knows what would have happened if Chris Paul was there? They could have stuck up the joint 2 games in a row. You never know. But it's always going to be a question of what if, and that's what stirs a lot of NBA conversations, was what if.
Right. And there's also the question, which, you know, probably doesn't get discussed enough. Like, do you think Chris Paul, through no fault of his own, hurt his chances of staying with the Rockets after he hurt his hamstring? Like, do you think that was kind of the move of all moves that really started the direction the Rockets ultimately went in, and ultimately trading him the following summer?
No, because the way I was told, you know, they obviously had a plan in place to keep him, and how they were going to manage the injuries and the minutes going forward. There was a plan in place. But in the NBA world, things can happen on the drop of a dime. And once Paul George was traded, that opened the door for Westbrook. And the only asset that you could have actually traded a one-for-one was Chris Paul. So there might have been some crazy math, you know, Morey could have done to possibly get all three of them. And I remember he said that they had tried to get all, like, keep Chris and get Russ. But that would have taken a hell of a lot of gymnastics in the CBA for that to happen. But, no, nah, it's a tricky situation, really. You, on one hand, you understand that Chris is a competitor, a great All-NBA player, future Hall of Famer. But the injuries were bad. And when Harden went on that crazy tear, that doesn't happen if Chris doesn't get hurt. And if Chris doesn't get hurt, who knows what the Rockets do? Because remember, they were in a bad place before the injury. They're losing a lot of games. So you just never know. Like, I feel like a lot of the NBA's discussion, like I said, is based on hypotheticals. You just never know what could have happened if Chris didn't get hurt. If Chris doesn't come down with the injury game 5, is he still all right game 6? He might have got hurt game 6. You just never know.
No, that's true. So that's interesting. You think the Rockets would have always made that Russ trade regardless of the injury history with Paul? Like, you think that was always going to happen?
Yeah, I do. I just think that partnership would run its course as far as those two guys were concerned.
But do you think if they had won a championship, do you think
winning cures everything? So if they would have won a championship, yes, they would have. I don't think you mess with success. Like, you don't tinker. I think if they would have won a championship, you would never hear anything about Mike D'Antoni's future. You would never hear anything about Chris Paul's future. You would never hear anything about anybody's future, because they would keep those guys in house and look to add to it, not subtract from a winning formula. So, yeah.
Yeah. It could also change some of their pursuits for guys like Jimmy Butler in free agency. It's interesting. It is an interesting rabbit hole to go down. It's going to be one of the greatest what ifs in NBA history, because I think it directly swung the championship race. And I think it also swinged a lot of things. It changed the course of the Rockets franchise. It is an endless conversation if you really want to go down this hole. But I do think we have properly discussed the context of the Chris Paul injury. I think we've finally had a good, you know, material discussion about it. I think more people need to talk about that Chris Paul hamstring in the in the correct framing.
Yeah.
Because I think it's an injustice to what Chris Paul was at that time for that Rockets team.
Right.
Right. Thank you so much for coming on, Kelly. Again, go subscribe to The Athletic and read Kelly's work. It's really, really good. It's worth your time and money.
Thanks, bro. Appreciate you, man.
All right, man.
Stay safe.
All right, that was my good friend Kelly Eco of The Athletic. You can follow him on Twitter at KellyEcoNBA. Make sure to subscribe to The Athletic. Make sure to go subscribe to this podcast if you really enjoyed it, on iTunes and Spotify and Google Play and every single podcast player known to mine. And give us 5 stars, because it really helps other people find the show. And yeah, guys, good night.